Okay. So I looked at Blackboard this morning and couldn't see any specific questions that had been posted up there that students wanted me to cover in the tutorial today. This isn't a lecture and it's not a practical class. The purpose of this is that if you've got issues that have come up from the content that we've been providing you in terms of the embryology component of your course, this is a good opportunity for you to raise those issues and get it answered for everyone at the same time, so everyone's on the same page. So I guess the easiest way to start this is to ask whether people came along today with specific questions that they wanted to raise this tutorial. Are you all just hoping to absorb knowledge just by being in the same room? Is that the way it works? Are there any particular issues of the content I've provided to you today in the practical classes, or having looked at the lecture notes, that's not clear to you as to what I expect you to know from the course? These are open-ended questions.
No, I guess the timing of stuff.
The timing of stuff,
yeah. Because, like, we tend to go in terms of layers, like mesoderm, cardiac, sort of stuff, but I think it's, like, lower than before.
Okay, so you must have gathered by now, BGDA, what I'm trying to do is to go on from the foundations, very brief overview of human development prenatally, into going into more depth into the trimester development of humans. And what I'm not attempting to do in any great detail is to cover specific systems. As I said, BGDB, the next cycle of BGD that you'll do, we'll go into detail of specific systems. So while I'll mention to you events that are occurring within those systems, you'll see on the online notes even that I cover, development of the gut, development of the face, the endocrines, and sexual development, all in BGDB. So the important component I'm trying to get across to you in this cycle is about the sequence of events that are occurring through development. So by the end of the course, you should understand key things that have happened early on in development, pre-implantation development, the implantation period, what happens in the third week of development, that critical time that I spent quite a bit of time in labs on in terms of what goes on in terms of the trilaminar embryo unfolding. And then once we get on into the fourth week and from then on through the embryonic period, I try and pick landmark events that are occurring within the embryo. So the timing of these events is really what I'm focusing on in BGDA cycle. So you've got a thought in the back of your mind, you know when the heart begins, which is like... Yeah, so week four, we see the heart as the first organ to form. Those sorts of key landmark events are the things that I'm trying to draw your attention to. But is that everything about the heart? Is it all over done in week four? No, what are we waiting for? This is how tutorials work. You know, I don't just talk at you, you talk back to me. What are we waiting for in the heart?
Separation.
Septation, yeah. And when's that going to occur? Week five to week six. So I guess general concepts about key developmental events is really what I'm trying to put into sequence for you. When's the limb form? When do you first see the limb on the external surface of the embryo? Yeah, nobody told me to be a pop quiz. So look at your notes. I tell you exactly when the limb forms. I talk about the differentiation of the limb in terms of the nucleus being undifferentiated and not having any internal structure. When is it recognisable as a limb on the embryo in terms of its overall structure? Week six. I guess in week six it's begun to have a hand paddle forming. But when I covered the concepts, it was mainly about week 8, we had the final structure and rotations occurring, and I gave you an overview of the events that occurred through week 8. While I indicate to you weeks that events are occurring, I've also told you that this represents the average of a broad range of events. So what's the most important concept that I've told you about the actual timing of these things? What are some of the important concepts?
Well, the timing determines when the systems are affected by gravity.
That's an extremely important thing to think about clinically. When the exposure to teratogen occurs, will it affect different systems differently? So that's certainly one of the important issues. What else do we need to think about?
It can vary, and generally it happens. One thing has to fall before the next one.
That's a sweet answer. So it's the sequence of events as they occur, not the absolute time. So one thing needs to occur before the next in order for the next developmental feature to occur. So while we may have a broad range of timing that occurs for each one of those events, it's the sequence that's important. You won't have one thing occurring before another. For example, something as simple as somatogenesis, you're going to have an older embryo with more somites than a younger embryo with less somites. So you should be clear about what are the events occurring within the first trimester, and specifically the first 8 weeks of development, and what's the thing that I say over and over again in every practical class about my embryonic timings. They're from fertilisation, and as soon as you leave me and go somewhere else, you'll be thinking about a totally different form of timing, which is the clinical timing, which is from when? Last menstrual period, LMP, also called gestational age. It's a really vague term because it's the easiest thing to work with clinically. Certainly, the ultrasound scans use that gestational age, but occasionally you'll see some people talking about from point of fertilisation. Okay. What we haven't covered yet, and so it's a bit difficult to go into any depth, is you haven't done the lab yet for fetal development. And when we do that lab, there'll be other issues that come up. I should mention to you that in fetal development, while it's physically a longer period of time, we'll be looking just at the systems which continue to develop through this period. So some of them only become functional through this period. Some of them begin to differentiate through intermediate stages. The best example of that is the respiratory system. That it goes through other changes through the fetal period, whereas many other systems are pretty much there in miniature by the end of the first trimester or the embryonic period. So when we do fetal development, we'll be talking about issues such as the weight and the length, and the things that can affect normal growth. So we change the concepts that we're trying to cover in the fetal period from organogenesis, which is how those structures initially form, to what can influence their growth in the fetal period. So that will be the last practical I do with you in Practical 12. Clearly, in order to cover all of human development just in three classes, we have to summarise and skim a lot of stuff. So you're not going to be covering every single thing about embryology. I do expect you to know the content that I've put on the pages for the lab notes and the content I've given you on the page for your lecture notes as well. And if there is additional material, I always label it as being additional, and that generally implies that it's not directly examinable. It's there to help you understand those concepts. Does that make sense? So I know people love to cram the stuff that they, you know, what do I need to know for this? That it's the stuff that's actually in the content pages for the, that I cover.
Just with your lectures, because I know that I write a lot of notes that's not actually on there.
Yes.
So you've done the form on today as well.
Sorry, I wasn't clear about that. Just from my lecture notes?
Just from your lecture notes, because a lot of the things that you actually talk about aren't like all the like the finer details. A lot of them aren't on the notes and some of the slides. So we've done it on what you say.
Because I cover different material as I'm talking to the content that's on the slide,
yeah,
is what
like,
you're saying?
Like additional things to go along with what's
going on. bit hard to answer. Often what I'm trying to do when I address my lecture material is to give you the same content in a slightly different way. And so it's occasionally not clear to me whether I've given you additional information in the verbal lecture as opposed to what's on the slides. So, I mean, I haven't got that great of memory that I can go back and think about what content I said that you shouldn't know, as opposed to what content you should know. I guess what I'd hark back to would be whatever I've written down in your lecture notes slides is the content you should be addressing. Yeah. One of the issues, though, really, is that given that I've only had two lectures, but I've got three labs with you, I had to decide what component I had to really cut out in order to cover only in the lab classes. And so in order to do that, I chose to take out the feeder period. So I really didn't cover feeder period in the lecture material in any great depth. And hence, the content that I covered from feeder development would be in the practical class. So make an effort as we go through the practical class to assist.
When you say that you didn't have no lectures, does that mean you can't be
Does that mean you can't be examined?
We're only examined in our practical exam at the end of the year.
Why wouldn't your practical exam cover all the content that would be in my practical classes?
Pardon?
I'm asking,
you said the field development wasn't in the lectures, you had to cut that out from the prac. Is that what you meant?
Yes.
So does that mean that in our BGD exam, we won't have the field development, we'll only have that in our end of the practical exam?
There's always one. Okay, so I'd expect... The practical classes cover the same content that's in the lecture material. But because I don't have the same number of lectures as I have practicals, I had to pull something out so that I'm not going 1,000 words a minute. And so I chose to take out feeder development to cover in depth in the lecture material, but I consider it to be theory as well as practical. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Thank you.
I've got to be careful because in the past people have made notes in these tutorials and they said this is what he said and I just want to be really specific. So what I'm saying is feeder development is a theoretical aspect as well as a practical part of the course. Having said that, then it's going to be important to understand what events occur through the feeder period, what occurs in the second trimester, what occurs in the third trimester. And as I said before, because you've not done a practical class, it's difficult for you to ask questions about what content you should be studying for that, but certainly you should try and divide it up into what occurs in the second trimester and what occurs in the third, what happens just before birth and those sorts of issues as well.
In terms of the embryonic period, something
I'm not sure
about everyone else is something that I find difficult is visualising the three-dimensional picture of like folding and falling in both directions of the disc.
Yep.
And especially because in our book we see flat, in Larson's and in our screen, and you have provided some
animations,
which help. But especially with the formation of the heart tube, I still can't visualise where it comes from.
So the issue really for that is that a lot of the textbooks, they change the position of where the heart tube forms. It's pre-caudal splanchnic mesoderm is its embryonic origin, which means that it has to lie above the notochord, and it lies above initially where the buccopharyngeal membrane is. And the folding of the embryo brings it ventrally down below the buccopharyngeal membrane. So there's that change in relative position. And often the textbooks are described as lying in a region below the buccopharyngeal membrane already in that correct anatomical location. So you should be aware that there are lots of different interpretations about embryonic development. It's still being argued. In particular, the biggest problem we have is that we don't have access to a lot of human embryos to easily manipulate or study. And so a lot of the work is based upon animal models. There is common themes in animal development in terms of the early stages, so the trilaminar embryo and folding and all the rest of it, but there will be differences between species as well. So while I spend a lot of time talking about folding the trilaminar embryo, it's only because I understand it's a difficult concept. I don't want to overemphasize it as being the major part of the course. it's really setting up the embryo for future development. You know, where do the bits come from? Clinically, it's not going to be a huge issue for you. You're not going to be really working at the trilaminar embryo stage in any particular clinical condition. In fact, you'll probably only ever come in late embryonic following some ultrasound or some prenatal diagnostic technique or some issue that the mother's had in relation to, you know, I was taking these drugs and I didn't know I was pregnant or I was drinking or I still smoked or those sorts of things. And really for you to put it in context about what's normally going on in biology. I can go through the folding again if it's going to help. I think I've got a story down where it's reasonably clear to understand about everything folding ventrally. As long as you've got that, that from a flat disc we fold everything around the notochord ventrally, and that we end up with a three-layered embryo from the core, the endoderm and mesoderm around the outside, then our intraembryonic coelom around the outside of that, and a bit more mesoderm than the ectoderm on the outside, you've got the basic embryonic structure that exists by the end of the third week in development. And then it gets complicated because each one of those separate components is going to contribute a separate organ or system within the embryo. So I picked landmark things like limbs and somites to follow on from. But as I said, in BGDB, we'll come back and look at those in much more detail.
I'm confused with the term gastrulation.
Yes.
Because it seems, because it says it sort of infers that it's talking about the gut forming, but it occurs in week three, and it doesn't really seem like the gut's forming then.
Well, it is.
It is, yeah.
Well, the endoderm that forms in that migration is the entire line of the gastrointestinal tract from one end to the other. So that process of gastrulation generating that endodermal layer is forming the primitive gastrointestinal tract.
And it seems to refer to more than just the gut.
Well, it is, because the terminology is a historic term that relates to what we watched with, you know, tadpoles during their process, and it's slightly different. And historically, when that folding occurred, they saw the formation of the gut tube in the animal models. But it is much more than that, because it establishes the three germ cell layers. So it's not only forming the endoderm, it's generating the middle layer of connective tissue, which is the mesodermal layer. And once you've established those three germ cell layers, you've set up all of the beginnings of your different tissues. So I don't know what else you'd call it, trilaminar embryo formation, or primitive street migration, something like that. But certainly the term is recognised in all the textbooks as just being purely gastrulation, which should be just mean endoderm, but if you think about it, the gut tube is more than just the epithelia that lines it. It's also the smooth muscle in the wall, it's also the connective tissue in the wall, and that all comes from the mesoderm. So unless you have mesoderm formation, then you're not going to have gut formation either. So it really does cover all of those issues. So I think in the timeline figures, I also gave you a good indication about the events that are occurring during this, maybe not the best one here. I had a better one. This one. So I tried to give you a broad overview in these times as to what's occurring in these first 4 weeks. And I guess some of the early stuff was about gametogenesis, which you'd cover in other classes as well. And I wanted to raise to you the importance of this time here when early development implantation is occurring, because, as I said, it's the time when we dispose of most of the major genetic abnormalities. There's a few that escape that normal screening, such as Down syndrome, trisomy 21. That's one of those ones that escapes that process. And when we get to the implantation stage, then all of the rest of development of the embryo occurs within the wall of the uterus. And in the lab that you're going to do on placentation, you'll be able to look at all the extra embryonic derivatives and how the placenta forms. So for you clinically, the placenta is going to be just as an important marker or indicator of normal prenatal growth and development. And it certainly is one of the areas where you get abnormalities occurring as well.
With abnormalities,
you know how each structure has like a critical period and then a period after which isn't as critical?
Yep.
What kind of like differences in abnormalities occur in those two periods?
Yeah, it's a good point. So the sorts of things that I would suggest would be a major abnormality, let's take the heart as a good example. A major abnormality there would be a ventricular septal defect, where the muscular and the membranous components of the ventricle septum fail to separate the two ventricles from each other. Now, that abnormality would happen during that critical time of septation, during the week 5 of development. And after the septum's been formed, then the septum still needs to grow, but it won't be abnormal. So exposure to the same teratogenic effect later on in development, say in the second trimester, is not going to prevent the septum forming, but it may prevent its growth. So it may not be as muscular as it should be for that period of time, but it still would be present. And so when we talk about major system abnormalities, we talk about the absence or the disruption of the normal structural formation, which leads down the track to major abnormalities. When we talk about minor abnormalities, it may be something, let me take another example that we haven't covered in detail, and it's the kidneys. Once you establish the adult nephron structures, then what you're influencing are the total number of nephrons that are generated during the fetal period, as opposed to the actual establishment of the kidney itself. So if you affected normal development of the metanephric kidney, the early stage when it's being conducted, you have total absence of the kidney. But if you get a teratogen later in the fetal period, it may be that that kidney won't grow normally, but it will still be present. So that's the difference between a major and a minor. So that's what I mean by a functional abnormality or a minor abnormality. Once again, in the graph, it's a clear cutoff, but it's not like that at all. If I was being serious, I'd have sort of a gradation there. But once you form the septum, then you're not going to affect that septum's formation. Does that make sense to you? So the table isn't an accurate table. Don't go out and say, this is the week that we need needs to be done. But I once again want to give you the concept that the earlier on in development, the more serious will be the impact. And this is really clinically why we keep pushing the first trimester as being a really critical time in human pregnancies, because so many things are going on and so many things can be affected. But having said all of that, I want you to bear in mind when you're talking to your patients when you're finally out there that development is a pretty robust system. You know, there are many examples of mothers being exposed to serious teratogenic effects which the fetus has been spared from. And so it's not a guarantee that it's always going to occur. It's more likely that it will occur. Just like fetal alcohol syndrome and smoking have effects, it's more likely to occur if you're exposing them to it than if they weren't exposed to it. Any other issues?
Sorry. Just trying to explain to my son, how rubella.
I don't know how to
spell. Actual brain malformation is actually quite rare, but then most of the brain damage is caused from ischemic lesions and retinopathy. So why is brain malformation so rare if rubella is involved with preventing color vision?
Well, it could relate.
And also, I read like it causes the tunica maxima to double in diameter. So why does it make it bigger? Something
so efficient. It sounds like I'm actually answering your rubella assignment question. As much as I'd like to help you with your assignment, I don't think it's my job to answer that. Why is the nervous system spared? Well, I don't think it's exclusively spared. There's certainly damage to the sensory systems, that's clearly laid out. I think sometimes it's related to the time of exposure. The nervous system is neurogenic for quite a long period of time, so you can actually ablate past the nervous system and still be able to generate the neurons. So maybe that's how the sparing goes on. You need to read the literature to find out. Certainly, one of the questions that did come up that I received was whether the assignment says that you need to cover development in relation to abnormalities. clearly within the space of an assignment, you can't cover all the aspects of development. So you should be selective on those aspects of development which you're impacted on. I hope that clarifies the structure of that particular assignment. But yeah, it's quite variable. There was another issue as well in terms that did come up, and it related to the normal menstrual cycle. Now, you did actually have a lecture in physiology and pharmacology from Trevor Lewis on menstrual cycle changes, and some of the groups talked about there being a difference between the curve that I gave you in my class, the curves that he gave in the lectures. The curves that I gave in the class were not meant to be an accurate representation of hormonal changes. You'll see that even in the textbooks, there's a huge variation in terms of how they depict it. I have changed the image slightly to represent the correct estrogen surge in the first phase and the slightly delayed temperature shift, a bit longer than the original graph showed. But the purpose of that graph was not to be an accurate representation. The graph that I've replaced it with is actual data from a menstrual cycle. So now I've gone to the other spectrum. I've made it so exact that there's more variation than you see in a normal cartoon version of the curve. I'd imagine you'd be expected to represent the simplified version rather than the highly detailed version. So it's shown here in this replacement graph where I more accurately show the slightly delayed temperature change and the clear estrogen changes here early on in development in the menstrual cycle. But remember, in my class, I wasn't so much interested in the menstrual cycle. We just wanted to get the egg out of the ovary and get it fertilised. So I really just introduced the menstrual cycle as the beginning of the whole aspect of development.
I was wondering if you had the channel screen, would there be two corpus
twins? If you had dizygotic twins? So if you had dizygotic twins and you would have had two ovulation events, then you potentially have two corpuses in it. Yeah.
So why don't you just atrophy?
Well, it's very difficult for me to say because there's not been a huge amount of studies on humans with human corpuses in. Generally, what's done when they do an ultrasound scan of the ovary, you can see a single corpus. You might have heard about people who've been doing ultrasounds for dizygotic twins to see whether they're two present or not. There have to be a corpus in there, at least one, if not two. Yes?
What if that happens to reduce identification?
What happens to reduce identification?
No, produce.
Oh, reproduce it. That's an interesting question. I wish I could tell you the answer to that. What it appears to be is at the early stage of inner cell mass formation, there's a cleavage event that occurs. So you can imagine that in that early time point, every single one of those cells in the inner cell mass could form an entire embryo by itself. And in fact, that's the basis of stem cell work, is the fact that you pull one of those out, you can make a whole embryo out of a single cell at that stage. So it's not clear whether it's an environmental teratogenic effect that leads to duplication of the whole axis formation and gastrulation, or whether there's a predisposition genetically, because there is some indication that there is, monozygotic twins to your family, that there's an inheritance for that, so there's some difference in the genetic makeup. So I can't tell you the answer. All I can say is that the inner cell mass is cleaved into two functionally distinct regions which go through the processes of gastrulation in order to generate all the fecal membranes, and the longer that event occurs or doesn't occur, then the more likely that the fetus will be, or the embryo will develop as a conjoint. So earlier on is the change, and I think I gave you that on the graphs as well.
When do the cells in the blastocyst
cease becoming stem cells?
When
do they stop being stem cells? When gastrulation occurs. Because once you've established gastrulation, then you've made the three germ cell layers and you pattern them already. So they're already predetermined then to contribute to
different components. So we talk about generating embryonic stem cells in the blastocyst stage to isolate the inner cell mast cells.
Even once gastrulation has happened, can the, generic mesoderm mitophagy then introduce cause back to the main mesoderm in the body? So, it might be a complete stem cell.
Yeah, so if you've already got a pre-patterned cell, then you can use it for some other connective tissue. What they're trying to do now is do it the other way around. I mean, this isn't part of the current course, but I'm actually interested. They're inducing these mesenchymal stem cells from adult stem cells. So if you take connective tissue, you produce four genes into it, you can turn it back into a progenitor cell that's mesenchymal and remnant mesenchymal. So the other way around. In terms of trying to generate any connective tissue from that earlier embryonic stem cell, that's what we're working on, trying to clarify the pathways in the digital. It's not part of the examination or anything, of course.
Did you have a case study about a 62-year-old woman with IVF?
Yes.
She wouldn't have endometrium test anymore because she doesn't have cycles, so how would she support?
Yeah, so she would have been hormonally stimulated as well, so part of the normal therapy would have been to give her a series of rounds of chemicals with mimic.
So if you were in a hope of meeting,
well, even at 62, there'll be a small remnant population there. What actually occurs is you're not getting enough follicles forming at the same time to generate progesterone surges again for an old menstrual cycle. So as you deplete the numbers, you're not generating the fertility that critical mass requires for the cycle to occur. But that doesn't mean that the stroma cell population is present there. You're just not generating enough follicles to generate progesterone surge. So that the artificial inducted.
Is IVF only for menopausal women, or is it for pre-menopausal
women as well? Yes, so IVF is used for women of any age. There are certain women who have genetic issues with their family, the Huntington's and things like that, whereby they're trying to get a healthy embryo and do prenatal genetic diagnosis on them. And there are also fertility issues. Fertility issues that relate to implantation that I've talked about before. Even young women who've had rounds of pelvic inflammatory diseases and have what I say scarring of the epithelium, which tends to be ectopic pregnancies, so they'd be a candidate for IVF as well.
And if you implant an embryo and treatment of causal means, you have to wait until she has ovulation and has a couple of
Well, it would depend whether she's infertile or not. So if she was having a normal menstrual cycle, then the HCG would be sufficient to. They do synchronize the cycles and everything up, but they artificially regulate the cycles through undergoing IVF. So they would go through a series of supplementation of hormones to get them to go. And in fact, prior to IVF, if they were infertile, they'd be given fertility drugs which lead to hyperovulation or similar to one. Yes.
Which
room
would
you send
to?
Oh, okay. So, all right. We'll come and sit down. Is everyone here from that room?
I think they're coming.
Okay. Look, if there's nothing directed after this, then I'll continue on for the group that have just come in. If not, there'll be another class tomorrow if you can attend that one. Same time, 11 to 12 tomorrow. Same location here, so I'll be going through the same content. But grab a seat. Okay. I lost my train of thought. What was I talking to? Okay. So circulation issues. This is probably related also to the placenta.
what I want you to think about is the exchange of nutrients between the mother's blood and the embryo's blood doesn't occur until quite late in embryonic development. So even all of those early week three, week four, all of those times, all of the exchange of nutrients is by the absorption of nutrients by the syncytial trophoblasts in the forming placenta. So you're not actually established the circulation interaction between the maternal circulation and fetal circulation. It's much later than it would appear to be from the textbooks and from what's described. So middle to late embryonic period is when you begin to get that exchange occurring. Having said that, red blood cells begin to form within the mesoderm, and they form within the mesoderm throughout the embryo and also in the mesoderm that surrounds the yolk sac. So the best example of this is from the mouse model. In fact, in the mouse, all of the early red blood cells come from the mesoderm in the that surrounds the yolk sac. It's a major contributor to red blood cell formation. But the areas where you see it would be in that extraembryonic mesoderm around the yolk sac. You'd also see the splanchnic mesoderm where the blood vessels are forming. And what's actually going on is within the mesoderm itself, a little patch of mesoderm begins to differentiate as hematopoietic. The outer cells of that patch will form the blood vessel wall, so the endothelial lining wall. The core of that little patch of mesoderm forms the first red blood cells, the stem cells. Now those stem cells don't have a home to go to, and what they eventually do is they initially lodge in the liver and spleen, and so the blood stem cells will reside there, proliferate there, and contribute to blood formation in those regions. And also the third home that they get is in the thymus, so the thymus is quite large in the fetus as well. So those three embryonic tissues are the equivalent of bone marrow to the fetus. It's only eventually that once bone marrow ossification commences that the stem cells shift their location from those three organs to the bone marrow site. So the things to take home from that is that embryonic interaction with maternal blood occurs late in the fetal period. Prior to that, it's a direct nutrition through absorption of the liquids, through the amniotic fluid, the yolk sac, the embryonic space. All the nutrients come in through those, just straight diffusion. And in fact, there's some good evidence. It's not part of your course. There's some good evidence that what you're actually trying to do is not expose the embryo to high levels of oxygen in early development. So high levels of oxygen may affect normal development. So that in the early phases, you're anaerobic development, if you like, more than aerobic.
So
how do
stem cells get from the spleen to the
muscle? They're carried in circulation.
So is that when you be able to get...
Yes, you can get them out of the placental cord. So even at birth, there are still stem cells present within the normal circulating blood. So not all the stem cells are located just within the bone marrow in development. They're still in circulation. So it's one of the other major differences that we see between mature circulation and developmental circulation. You never see, you would hardly ever see any undifferentiated blood cells in circulation. They do all of their maturing within the bone marrow, except for the lymphocytes, and then be released into circulation into the vasculature associated with that. So for those that came late, follow your own, it's probably my fault. What I said was the content I expect you to know is the stuff that's actually on the web pages for the lecture materials or the lab notes. Anything that's just additional information is just that. It's to help you understand the content. I did have a question earlier on that in the lectures I tended to talk in parallel to the content that I actually have on my slides. And so that additional verbal material is examinable as well. And I tried to clarify that by stating that what I try and do in the lectures is to say the same thing but in a slightly different way to how it's written out. So the written slide material should be enough in terms of the theory that you'd be expected to know. And if I use extra concepts as I talk, I can't help that. I'm just interested in embryology. So
I'm definitely not going to not answer your questions, but it doesn't necessarily mean when I answer them that it's an examinable component of the content, and I've tried to clarify that as we've gone along. So stem cell issues I don't think are a core feature of the concept that I've been covering, whereas the sequence of events, the timing of events, you know, in the embryonic period and the fetal, is significantly on standard part of NGPA. And the other issue that I covered for is that because I don't have three lectures in the current core structure, I shift a lot of the content of theory for fetal development into the lab and don't cover it in the actual lectures. So it might be a bit light on the fetal content of the two theory lectures, but I consider the fetal component that I cover in the lab to also be part of the theory. And I did also ask at the beginning if there are any specific questions. So if you have any questions that you want to come along today and ask. I don't like Blackboard, so I don't generally do anything on Blackboard itself. I do like to have freely available information, so if I'm asked questions, I usually post it up on a website where everyone can see the answer. Well, fraternal twins should have two placentas. They may have them quite closely planted together, and they may appear to share a common placentation site, but I imagine that would be extremely rare. I've not heard of a case like that. And therefore, they might impact upon placentation themselves. It's probably more important to think about abnormal sites of implantation and abnormal methods of implantation layout. Twins are interesting, but not fascinating. Nobody ever likes the same twins in that analogy, but clinically twins are fabulous tools for us to work with because they manage to separate genetic effects from environmental effects when you've got genetically identical twins, and even that today we know is true because of the imprint effects that are different between these monozygotic twins. Any questions over here? Okay, the question is endoderm exclusively made by endoblast cells, or is there a hyperblast contribution? It's made from endoblast cells. So hyperblast is a transient layer that is replaced by endoderm. Some textbooks and other species suggest it's a hyperblast contribution. For humans, it's endoderm from gastrulation. It's a transient structure that exists. I introduce it because it's there in the second week of development. It's one of the first key events that occur during the inner cell mass dividing into two layers. But that layer, the hyperblast, is totally replaced by endoderm lining that previously occurred. This is also another terminology that comes up quite often in the textbooks that students find confusing. That first face lined in the second week by hyperblast is often described as primitive yolk sac or primary yolk sac. It's not the yolk sac I'm talking about. I try and avoid that terminology altogether because if it only exists in transient in the second week, the yolk sac I'm talking about is the one that's established following gastrulation with endoderm lining it, and then the extraembryonic mesoderm covering the surface of that yolk sac as well. That structure to me is the yolk sac that I'm talking about in the developmental talks, and particularly when we go on to talk about developmental starch. Some other questions up the side here? I am, of course, happy for you to send me questions at any time. In previous years, I sort of put a page together where questions that are sent to me, I give one answer to, and all the students can look at it. I've not received a lot of questions, and as I said, there weren't a lot posted on Blackboard there for me to respond to today, but I'm quite happy to write for a written answer up on the web that you can all refer to. I much prefer answering, rather than individuals, questions directly, to really post it up for everyone to have the same response. Otherwise, I answer the same question a thousand times.
If you're is the fluid in the amniotic cavity produced by the embryo?
Fluid in the amniotic cavity is made originally by the cells that lie in the cavity themselves. So they're secreting that fluid into the spaces. So a lot of the original fluids in the chorionic space are generated from the mesoderm lining of the chorionic space. Those cells secreting fluid in there and accumulating. Eventually, though, once the embryo is developed and the bipharyngeal membrane is broken down, then there will potentially be a contribution from the embryo, but it's generally the other way around, because generally what the embryo is doing is shedding epithelial cells into the fluid-filled space and swallowing the amniotic fluid. So it's the actual swallowing of the amniotic fluid that appears to be important in regulating overall volume, and there are abnormalities associated with failure to swallow an increase in volume. Again, self-lined walls that make the majority of the fluid. And remember, the fetus, when the kidneys form, will be urinating in the space as well. Anything else within the lab classes which weren't answered clearly, or you look back through your notes and you think it isn't clear to you? Yes, I've got it. What the difference between somatic and somatic? Does anyone else even know the answer to that question? The somites are the ones with the eye, okay? The somatic one is the one inside the somite. The somatic mesoderm is the one out in the lateral plate mesoderm. So here's our notochord in the middle, here's the somite, that's somatic mesoderm. Out here in the lateral plate is where we split the lateral plate into somatic mesoderm and splenic mesoderm. Totally different embryonic origins. They're both mesoderm, but they will form quite different structures. So these will form connective tissues of the body wall, plus skeletal elements and the lean buds for those levels adjacent to the ends. The somite will make vertebral body and vertebral disc and sclerotome. It'll make the dermis, that is all of the underlying skin regions, and will contribute the skeletal muscles of the body. So if the skeletal muscle in the body, it's come from the somite. And remember, when I go through development, I always refer to the body. And it's with good logic, because the body structure and development is quite different from how the head forms. So in BGDV, you do a lab and a lecture on head development, and everything up there is quite different. I don't specify head development in BGDA just because some of the embryonic origins are so different, it's just too confusing. So once I start talking about neurofresh contribution to mesodermal structures, it just mixed everything up. So we'll leave that to BGDB. Just be aware that the head development is significantly different from the trunk development of the embryo. But I would expect you to know when features appear, at least. How does the heart tube form? The heart tube is just a specialised form of the process that I was talking about earlier on in terms of how we form blood ions in the splenic mesoderm. It's specified in the prechordal region as a simple tube. It's a long tube that runs down into the lateral plate where the rest of the splenic mesoderm is forming the blood vessels. And as it folds ventrally and over, it changes the position of the heart from being a horizontal structure to a vertical structure. So it's folding, and it's fixed at either end. So imagine you've got a tube that's attached at either end, and when you flip it over like that, it's still attached at either end. And now, as it continues to grow in a fourth week, because it's fixed at either end, you can't grow, it buckles inside the cavity in which it lies and forms that S-shaped structure of the heart. As it buckles, it grows in length, and that forms the primitive atrial and ventricular regions. You did have a lecture on this. Yeah. Cardiogenesis is a really complex topic. You should look at the online tutorial that the island Stephen put together. I think she summarised quite clearly the events that go on in early cardiogenesis. Once again, I've been covering the detail of the facts, because it's one of those independent learning sort of things.
In the notes, she said, I'll be
How can that work? Well, it fuses in the middle. It's a tube like this, but it's horseshoe shaped, and it folds over, it fuses in the middle like that. Yeah. I think there's another class here afterwards. For those who came late and didn't feel that they got enough, I've got this class again tomorrow, same time, same place. If you do have additional questions that weren't covered, I do have another lab class for you, so you can always ask me in the lab class if there's content that you're not clear about. Thanks everyone for your time.